Great. So I'm Rick Hansen, and this is March 8th, 2009. I'm so bad at that, aren't I? 2016. And we've been focusing this year so far on mindfulness, and we're going to kind of keep doing that over the course of the year. And if you're interested in getting, as best we can tell, the Buddha's own fundamental teaching about mindfulness, we've printed up some copies of a good translation of what are called the four establishments or four foundations or four applications. It's my current favorite word, applications of mindfulness. And we've printed some out, and I think we might still have some left over there, and I'll keep bringing some, you know, extras, you know, routinely. All right? So far we've been exploring kind of an overview of mindfulness. What is it? What are some ways to understand it? What are some of the factors of it? And tonight I sort of want to finish up that introductory phase and then start moving more into each of the four applications of mindfulness, foundations of mindfulness, beginning with the body, which has a lot of really interesting material in it, including related to things like healing from old pain, engaging the so-called somatic markers in the body that anchor a lot of our emotional triggers and turbocharge a lot of needless suffering. So that's kind of a topic we'll be engaging down the road. Tonight I want to review some fundamental Buddhist themes in terms of what we're mindful of and how we help ourselves become mindful, and then try to get through that fairly quickly so that we have as much time as possible for discussion. Okay? So, what are we mindful of? We could be mindful of all kinds of things. The Buddha, as best we know, it is said that he said, as best we know, the Buddha said that our existence as living creatures, human creatures, has three fundamental characteristics. And being mindful of these three fundamental characteristics of our existence can be ultimately liberating. So what are these three characteristics? The first is impermanence. Certainly our own experience is continually changing. And this moment of existence is temporally razor thin in terms of time. It could end at any moment. It's quite radical to appreciate that whatever you were experiencing 10 seconds ago is no longer here. I had this very odd experience. I went to my 20-year high school reunion some years ago, and how many will leave to your imagination for the moment, but anyway. And what was really interesting is that high school for me as a kid, for multiple reasons, was a very intense, mainly intensely unpleasant experience. Lots and lots of awkward moments, shyness, difficulty, dread. There was a lot going on. So when I worked up my courage to go to my 20-year high school reunion and face my demons, right, all those people, what was really interesting, I went to a large high school, about 27, almost 2,800 people altogether. And when I walked into this hotel ballroom where it was all laid out for several hundred, certainly, if not more, of the seniors in my class of 700, I walked into the room and I did not recognize a single person. It was as if I had walked into a random 20-year high school reunion from any high school, any county in this country, more or less. It was as if it didn't happen, and or hadn't happened, and I realized that where it was continuing to happen was only inside my own mind, in terms of impermanence, things changing, things pass away. You know, there's a Zen story, you may know it, where two monks, a senior monk and a junior monk, who have taken very serious vows of celibacy and disengagement from women, these are male practitioners, come to a muddy river, and standing on the one side of the muddy river, their side, is a beautiful princess, right? Dressed in flowing robes and gowns and silks and so forth. And without thinking too much about it, the senior monk says, "Oh, would you like me to carry you across?" And she says, "Oh, well, thank you very much." So he carries her across, sets her down on the other side, and they keep going up the trail. Meanwhile, the junior monk is obsessing the whole way up the trail. How could he do that? How could he break his vows? How could he hold her soft thighs in his arms? How could he feel her hair brushing against his neck? How could he keep smelling her perfume across the river? You know, finally he bursts out, right, and he complains to the senior monk. How could you do that? How could you do that? And the senior monk looks at him in surprise, says, I set her down on the other side. You've been carrying her ever since, right? Think about how, what we carry with us instead of letting it pass away. It doesn't exist anymore, unless it does. But most of what troubles us actually doesn't exist anymore, except between our own ears. So it can be very profound and very powerful to recognize the transience of experience, to recognize passing away, and also recognize, honestly, not to freak anybody out, but the movie of your life, this experience we're all having, can end at any moment. And most of us will not know when that moment will come. Can end very suddenly. At any moment, the movie can stop. No more experiences. At least in this body, in this life. Whatever else might be true. So in the recognition of impermanence, we lighten up about what's passing through us. We stop squeezing the rope of life, as it were, passing through our hands so tightly. That reduces our suffering. We start, we decrease obsessing about the past, beating ourselves up over it, holding on to regrets and grievances against others. Doesn't mean we become a doormat, doesn't mean we don't work through our trauma as we need to or confront other people about things they may have done, but we generally hold all that a lot more lightly. And we also get a lot less attached to what might happen next. And we live more in a kind of not knowing. So there's this mindfulness first of impermanence, that first characteristic of existence. And it was actually said for many, many centuries after the Buddha passed away that the way that people would identify themselves as seriously engaged in the path that he laid out was that they recognized impermanence. They recognized, as it is said, that all that is subject to arising is inevitably also subject to passing away. Okay. Impermanence. The second characteristic of existence is not self. This is a topic that can spin out into a lot of philosophizing. The Buddha discouraged what he called the thicket of views, getting lost in this thicket, this tangle, this bramble fest of opinions about this or that. He simply makes the observation that if you look directly in your own experience, the presumed stable, unified, independent I, this sort of ego self, cannot ever be found in its full package. You'll find lots of references to it in your experience, lots of presumptions about it, but it itself you never find. What you find is this tapestry of experience comprised of many threads, but no single thread in charge of the whole show. And this local moment of experience with many, many aspects caused by many, many things stretches out into other people around you, nature, culture, society, the whole physical universe, and is kind of the momentary eddy in the stream of reality based on all the causes that were upstream. And that's actually the truth of things. So recognizing not self, not an enduring unified entity somewhere inside, that it's really a process. It's an unfolding symphony of music happening without some inner boss driving the whole process or in charge of it all. And mindfulness of that is really useful because as you do that, you take life less and less personally. And instead of feeling like an individual separated from everything and therefore very vulnerable and needing to possess and pile up and polish, you know, you got to keep polishing yourself, keep burnishing this kind of independent entity. Instead of that, you start feeling actually more and more tuned into everything, more and more like a local wave in a vast ocean, and becomes less and less important what's happening momentarily, because you feel more and more kind of like a local expression of everything. And that has a lovely feeling of peacefulness, and along with it, a lot of releasing of selfishness and quarreling with other people. So that's the second great characteristic. And he says, of course, see for yourself. See if you think these are actually real characteristics of human existence. Then third, in addition to impermanence and not self, which is a different way of saying allness, okay, same thing, there is the mark of existence that is suffering and the engine of suffering. In other words, there is this dynamic in you know, our minds and our animal life in which we suffer. We add suffering to inevitable pain and discomfort of various kinds. And so the causes of that suffering can often be seen as a kind of grasping or craving or kind of insisting that things be a certain way, that they, including that they not change, which of course is going to make us upset. So we have these three characteristics, he said, that we are to be mindful of. Change, impermanence, transience, endings, arisings and endings, endlessly, right? Impermanence is permanent. Second, a kind of distributed quality, a spread outness, a oneness with everything quality, a compoundedness, a dynamicness to our own consciousness. Yes, there is a body. Yes, this body is different from your body, but we don't need to feel that there's some kind of brick-like entity inside looking out through our eyes. And then third, the fact of suffering, our own and others, and its causes. Those are the three marks of existence. In Pali, anicca is change, anatta is not self, dukkha is suffering, a kind of inescapable, unsatisfactoriness in everyday, in the flow of experience, in the sense that it's because it's transient and insubstantial, it's incapable itself, experiences, any experiences, incapable of being a reliable, lasting basis of happiness. That's really a different way to say the same thing. The third mark of existence, suffering and its causes. Okay? That's basic Buddhism. Good to know. Three things. Okay? My dad, no longer alive, grew up in North Dakota, on a ranch, and ultimately became a scientist. So he had that sort of North Dakota, Midwestern, Lutheran origins, down-to-earth straightforwardness. And as a scientist, he was very, he was a critical thinker. And so I wrote the book, Buddha's Brain. He started reading it. It's really a trip to have your dad read your book and call you up and say, Rick, you know, paragraph 4, page 79, I want to ask you a question about that. You know, because he's the kind of guy who would literally underline the instructions for the manual for his printer. You know, he's a very detailed guy. Anyway, so that was fun. Anyway, so one time, so he starts reading and he calls me and he says, you know, Rick, I think this Buddhism stuff is great, but it's just not for me because I'm happy already. It's for people who are suffering, right? Who are miserable. like your mother, anyway. So, like you, Rick, in other words. And so I said, well, Dad, let me think about this for a second. I say, well, a long time ago, the Buddha noticed, and my dad was an ecologist. That was his discipline. He was a zoologist about ecology. And I said, Dad, a long time ago, the Buddha noticed that, observed that, first, everything changes. Second, everything's connected to everything else. And third, if you sort of get with that program, you stay happy. But if you fight those two facts, you suffer and you create harm for yourself and others. And he's nodding the whole time. Good scientist, right? Things do change. Everything's connected to everything else, you know. What's the John Muir line? You know, I find that I'm hitched to everything in the universe. Isn't that great? I'm hitched to everything in the universe. And then last, third characteristic of existence around suffering and its causes, pragmatically, if we align with the truths of existence, we don't add insult to injury. There's inevitable pain, old age, disease, and death, etc., including our emotional sorrows that are inevitable as social animals. We care about others. We're affected by others. But generally, if we kind of get with the basic program of impermanence and interdependence, you know, we're connected with everything, then we suffer less, we harm less. Alternately, if we fight those two facts, we create a lot of trouble for ourselves and other people. So my dad's nodding all the time. And I said, Dad, you didn't realize it, but all along, you've been a Buddhist. Oh. Yeah. I thought it was one of my better rejoinders, you know. Anyway, so where was I? Yes, we have those three characteristics. Okay, good to know. Okay, so far? So then, kind of briefly, how do we cultivate and embody in a very deep and increasingly broad, deep, and continuous knowing of the truth of things? It is said that there are three fundamental pillars of practice that enable us to do this. The first one is virtue, restraint, morality. I'm thinking of this quotation from, I think, Shantideva, one of the great Tibetan adepts. He says, my view is as vast as the heavens, but my attention to cause and effect is as fine as a grain of flour. In other words, he's really watching what creates harm, what creates benefit, what creates suffering, what creates happiness. And he's trying to, under the heading of virtue, restraint, morality, cultivate non-harming, fundamentally. First and foremost, non-harming of ourself. And of course, as well, non-harming of others. And that works together in a nice positive cycle. So we do cultivate virtue. There's a moral dimension here. Virtue is often expressed simply as non-killing, non-stealing, not false speech, not harming yourself and others with sexuality, not clouding the mind with intoxicants that lead to heedlessness. Those are the big five precepts, as it were. But of course, there's more to the dimension of sila or virtue. Sila is the word in Pali for this pillar of practice, such as different aspects of right speech, right livelihood, and right action. Three of the elements of the Eightfold Path. So it's worth, you know, it's interesting to me that very much we tend to get interested in sort of the psychology of Buddhism and also sort of the big picture principles of it. And very much of it, from a very practical standpoint, has to do with, you know, clean up your act, don't be a jerk, you know what that edge is, you know, how to, you know, go to the next level of kind of purifying your own mind, clearing out the crud, and being really attentive to impacts on yourself and others of acts of thought, word, and deed, intentional acts of thought, word, and deed. So that's, and it's true. As you're less entangled with cycles of harming of others and harming you, as you feel less burdened by the thought that you've done something wrong, you know, regret, remorse, guilt, your mind gets clearer and clearer, emptier and emptier, and quieter, and you're more able to practice. So that supports mindfulness, the first pillar of practice, sila, or morality or virtue. It's worth just kind of a little internal check. How am I doing? You know, almost everyone, me included, knows the next step. Take the next step in your own personal development of virtue. goodness of one kind or another. The second great pillar is called samadhi, and it has to do with deepening your concentration, your steadiness of mind, and also purifying and clearing stuff out, especially the hindrances, so-called, in the mind, like anger or greed or doubt or restlessness, remorse, or a kind of bleh, sometimes called sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor. And also cultivating peace and joy. That's more or less the essence of the samadhi pillar of practice, which in the Eightfold Path boils down to wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, including opening into quite profound, non-ordinary states of consciousness. That also helps us be more and more mindful. I could say for myself that my own practice really took off when I started some of the keys, but for me, one of them was focusing on concentration practice and meditation, steadiness of mind, and kind of deliberate muscular training in steadiness of mind. And in that, the cultivation of, oh my goodness, tremendous bliss and joy and a sense of unification of consciousness, it's sometimes called. A second major thing that really led my practice to taking off was a focus on joy, on positive emotion, including the joy of love, loving others, and feeling loving, and kind of marinating in it, and letting your mind be washed clean by the bliss of love. I recommend it to you. So did the Buddha. He recommended it to me, just passing it on. And then last, finishing up, the pillar, how do we cultivate this mindfulness, right? Especially mindfulness of these three characteristics of existence. The pillar of wisdom, in Pali, Panya. So we have sila, samadhi, and panya, virtue, concentration, absorption, a very visceral, embodied transformation that's very juicy. It's the samadhi pillar of practice, as well as wisdom. Really understanding fundamentally what causes suffering and harm, what causes happiness and benefit for oneself and others. Right? And as you cultivate wisdom, you become more able to sustain this mindfulness of these three characteristics of existence, which helps you deepen more and more fully in a fundamental liberation from suffering and a fundamental increasing resting, as I've seen in my own development, and also when I look further up the path at people who are farther along than I am, a fundamental resting and an increasingly unconditional sense of inner peace and contentment and love. As the Buddha said, to finish, a path that's good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. So that's the offering there. Some basic Buddhism, fundamental ideas, and finishing here and then seeing what you think about it. In the beginning, there's one of the, again, I'm quoting all these Tibetans, I can't remember their names, but oh well. I think one of the early Tibetan great teachers described his own practice. He said, in the beginning, nothing came. You know, we struggle. It doesn't come to us. You know, it's like trying to light a fire with wet wood. Okay. But then with some practice, things do come to us. A greater sense of calm, a greater steadiness of mind, a few minutes in a row in a meditation where we have a stable sense of centeredness and stable presence, a kind of ease. Someone else is being aggravating, but we don't let ourselves feel aggravated. You know, isn't that interesting? We're stuck in traffic and we don't freak out about it. We do something wrong and, you know, we don't keep beating ourselves up. We learn the lesson and keep moving. Things come to us. But as he said, in the middle, nothing stayed. It's not permanent yet. It's not irrevocable. It's not fully established. And then he said, though, with practice, increasingly, as things do come, increasingly, as he said, at the end, nothing left. In the beginning, nothing came. In the middle, nothing stayed. In the end, nothing left. And that, to me, is a very useful set of milestones for this progressive process we're engaged in. That's why we're mindful. Okay. Buddhism 101, but pretty hardcore at the same time. So what do you make of all that? Please.
From the meditation, can you explain how letting go of your mind the way your mind is not contradictory with developing attention and control over your emotions?
Yeah, that's a great question, isn't it? And so I'll just restate it if I could. So in the meditation, I was passing on these four suggestions from one of the, I can't remember the name, great Tibetan teachers, who said, right, let go of the past, let go of the future, stay in the present, leave your mind alone. So about leave your mind alone, but wait a second, aren't we trying to cultivate things? And I think part of the key is we're talking about meditation. So it's a particular practice, right? That's an important point. So during this practice, say, we see what it's like to not fabricate anything in our mind, not try to make something happen other than the minimal necessary, as I was suggesting, to be able to stay present. So it helps to be a little relaxed, a little calm, because when we're agitated, it's hard to stay in the present. And it's also hard to leave. If you're really unhappy or miserable, it's hard to leave your mind alone, you know? If your back is killing you, why not move in the chair? You know, there's a place for that because it's hard to do that practice when you're upset about something. And in their tradition, especially, there's this notion that as you leave your mind alone, and we're talking about people who were very, very seriously engaged in practice. That was the primary focus of their life. That as you leave your mind alone, more and more you recognize its nature. And you start recognizing its fundamentally pristine, pure quality of kind of spacious peacefulness. That mind itself, if you leave your mind alone, it starts leaving you alone, you know? And you start recognizing that the contents of mind can be disturbed, right? And have a sense of deficit, you know, like there's not enoughness. If you think of that's kind of the hallmark of that characteristic of suffering, dukkha, you know, of not enoughness and a disturbance, you know, the root of the word you may know for dukkha, the word for suffering in Buddhism, is the two parts, du means kind of wonky, not good, you know, not, you know, kind of, not right. And ka is the meaning of an axle and the hub of a wheel, because these are words that came from a very rural agrarian culture 2,500 years ago. Mainly pre-literate, mainly certainly pre-technological, broadly defined, or in modern terms. Anyway, so if you think of it as a wobbly grinding, right? It's disturbed, it's imbalanced, you know, it's da-da. So, that's content, right? But mind altogether, you just kind of relax, and there is mind, there is a mind process occurring. That's where we always start, right? There is a mind process occurring, but that process altogether is just fine. And you start opening into it. That's that progressive teaching. So, you know. And to me, it's interactive, and all these teachers will say that as you leave your mind alone, that helps you cultivate certain wholesome qualities. And as you cultivate certain wholesome qualities, it's easier and easier to leave your mind alone and kind of abide increasingly as this nature, a kind of spacious, peaceful wakefulness.
Okay. It's sort of like you were saying, by paying attention to it, developing your attention on it, you can see the sky that the cloud's going through.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. And that's a traditional metaphor. You become more and more the sky. Leave your mind alone. And above all, of course, it's an exploration. See what it's like. You know, I think often what happens, people start experiencing a kind of boundlessness because there's no bound, there's no edge to mind. If you think, you know, it's like, yeah. Okay.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. Huh? When I came out here to California, it was about 1972, and I joined a Kundalini yoga ashram. And of course, it was very difficult to meditate. And then all of a sudden, when I got the gist of it, I felt as if I felt like all of a sudden I was tiptoeing through my mind going, oh my God. You know, it's sort of like just like total quiet, you know, just
that's
just
great.
Felt like such a gift.
Yeah.
All of a sudden I was like tiptoeing. Nothing. Yeah, just peace.
I think that's great. For me in my own practice, both have been really important. One is to deal with content, right? So, you know, whatever that content might be, I was thinking about how many of my stories start with this, a line kind of like this. There I was standing there while my wife was telling me how to load the dishwasher properly. You know, like so many stories kind of start that way, right? And, you know, so yeah, there's a lot of content to deal with, right? Like our greed, our hatred, our delusion, our possessiveness, our addiction to one thing or another. You know, there's a lot of content to work with. Okay, so we work with content, content of mind, right? We have our back pain. That's content. We have our rivalry with somebody else. We have, you know, the hurt that someone has mistreated us. Okay, we're dealing with content. But another thing is to not deal with content, not struggle with content, not try to change content, but drop out into process, in effect. You know, drop out into mind altogether. So there's like the parts of mind. And if you think of the structure of most suffering, if not all of it, is some part of us struggling with another part of us, right? See the cookie, that's a part. Want the cookie, that's another part. Third part says, no, no, not the cookie. Fourth part says, Sharon Salzberg says, accept yourself. That means accepting cookies. And, you know, there you are, right? And you can go part, part, part. There's a place for that. But it's really cool sometimes to drop into what's the nature of each one of those parts. Transient, they're impermanent, and they're ownerless. They're just arising and passing away. And so I find both of those are very powerful forms of practice. You know, work with parts, okay, and also go out into the whole. Any other, what do you think of this hardcore Buddhism?
I really appreciate you sharing the story about your dad, because my own academic training is in ecology and evolutionary biology, and these teachings have come later. But almost immediately there was a resonance between impermanence. As an evolutionary biologist, you can demonstrate it empirically, everything changes. And certainly the interconnectedness, you could demonstrate that empirically too. But I love the way that when you first introduced these characteristics, it wasn't about interconnectedness, it was from non-self, which is another way of getting at it, which for me personally is a more helpful way for me to try and navigate my own personal life, maybe not as a scientist, but as a human being, a husband, and a high school biology teacher, where non-self is critical, I think, and not being, well, I'm always triggered by things that kids do, but not responding in a judgmental way. My own work is trying to replace the judgment with sincere curiosity.
Right.
Tell me more about why you did that or why you said that kind of thing, which goes miles to, I think, helping, in my relationship with the kids, but truly allowing them to grow and develop. So I really appreciate you offering two different angles of coming at interconnectedness.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for that. And it's funny, my wife and I were doing our taxes, right? So we met with our accountant today. And here's this really interesting thing. Here's this accountant, a really nice guy. And I found myself wanting his approval. And I'm thinking, wait a second, we're paying you. And you're a nice guy, and I talk to you twice a year, you know, like, and yet I kept wanting his approval. And it was funny. What was odd about it was that it was so incongruous to the situation. Like, I want your approval that I got all my forms together with a nice paper clip, and I want your approval that we actually made a little money last year, so now we have a problem that requires your help, and, you know, I want your approval about that, or, you know, I say this witty thing in the meeting, I want your approval about, isn't that interesting? You know, like, again, self. I mean, there's so much about that, and each time I did that, there's a little bit of contraction in me, rather than just kind of relaxing and being with whatever was there, you know, so. I guess the thing I would really like to offer to you is, this has been really true for me, is that there are two parts to this path or practice, you know. One part is the immediacy of moment-to-moment practice with, you know, what's happening in our body, what we're doing with other people, watching those, what's coming up in the mind, including things like clinging to approval or subtly working the accountant, you know, to get him to smile at what you're saying, things like that, right? It's so immediate. You know, what do you do when your partner tells you how to load the dishwasher correctly, right? Or your kid doesn't call you back, right? What do you do with that? Or someone you don't like politically has won an election recently or something. You know, what do you do with that? Like, but see, that's very right here, right down. That's what I think Shantideva was saying about that grain of barley flour, that attention to the immediacy of this experience. It's very down here, right now. And also, the other aspect of the path, though, is, you know, its profundity, that it's a path that takes us all the way out, as you were bringing up, to the nature of mind altogether, to opening out into reality altogether. Clearly, in early Buddhism, and you certainly see it in the three other branches after that, you know, Tibetan, Zen, and Pure Land, there's this engagement with the transcendental. You know, the Buddha called it the unconditioned, the deathless, the unchanging, the stainless, sorrowless, innate purity of mind. But it's really quite radical. It's not just about be nicer and pay more attention. That's good, right? But it's really ultimately really quite profound. And that's the opportunity and the invitation for all of us. And for me, it's been really, really meaningful and helpful to encompass both ends of that spectrum, to honor the immediacy of what I'm going to do with the fact that I need to go home momentarily to take my wife to Santa Cruz before the hurricane comes tomorrow, whatever. She's worried about weather. Okay, no worries. And, you know, the immediacy of that, but also not selling yourself short, not aiming too low, you know, being interested in the ultimate possibilities for yourself in this life. Yeah. Okay, so I'll be back in 2 weeks and we're going to get into mindfulness of the body. How about a moment of sitting and then we'll head on out of here. Thank you. Three characteristics, right? Enjoy your impermanence. Back here, back here. Take care, you all.
Rick, I was just gonna
say you can go if you want.
Oh, I'm going to go.
And Lily can bring Vedana to Jan on Friday, and we have lunch.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I'm out of here.
You know what?
Let me unplug. Bear with me one moment.